Thanks very much, Stuart, and thank you everybody for giving me the opportunity to address a few very, very important issues with you at this CEDA lunch this afternoon. I think the last time I addressed your organisation was in my role as the Trade Minister, and of course these two portfolios are intrinsically linked in terms of our interaction, if you like, with the rest of the world, and the significant achievements that we've made over recent years in terms of that economic reach as far as our export effort is concerned, and obviously at the moment being tested in a number of different ways, and, primarily with the very high exchange rate for the Australian dollar, I'm sure is testing many of our exporters and their ability to negotiate deals in the markets across the world. But just as important is the competitiveness and the efficiency of the logistical supply chain back at home here in Australia, getting those products from the farms, from the mines, from the manufacturing points through the transport networks in Australia and to the export ports, and then actually getting them across the wharves and onto ships and overseas. And so they're the two very, very important areas of policy, I suppose, for Australia, given the situation we are in at the moment economically in the growth phase we are in. But I come back into this portfolio, having been absent from it for almost 10 years. So this is my second incarnation as Australia's Transport Minister. I had a stint in the portfolio between 1997 and 1998, and many things have stayed the same, and there are many things have changed. The one thing that has changed is the level of investment that the Commonwealth Government is making individually and in conjunction with many of our partners, that is the state governments and local government and the private sector across Australia, and I'll comment on a few of those things shortly. But we should always take the opportunity of reflecting a little bit on where we've come from, and that gives us an indication of some of the challenges that still are before us. In the 1930s, the fastest way to travel from Sydney to Brisbane, believe it or not, was by train. The New Brisbane Limited had a lounge car for its first-class passengers. They were given complimentary tea and biscuits when they woke up, although the train still stopped for meals along the way. Now, the passengers' safety was assured because the line was controlled by the old electric staff system. And those rail buffs here would know what that is. At regular intervals, the driver would stop the train to collect a small metal staff from a hulking red piece of electrical equipment along the side of the line. At the Queensland border, the line rose 65 feet in the space of a mile as it looped upward through two tunnels before crossing the rugged Lamington Plateau. It was state-of-the-art technology for the 1930s that was deployed here in Australia. Now, one of the reasons that Australia faces so many transport problems now is that much of that 1930s technology still exists in operation, and that's a significant challenge to us as a nation. The line north was still controlled by the old electric staff equipment that was introduced in the 1930s, when the Commonwealth Government took over a 60-year lease of that north-south line in 2004. And they're the sorts of things that we were confronted with. And every freight train between Sydney and Brisbane still has to squeeze through the tunnels of the border loop. In 2004, it took 21 hours for a freight train to make its way from Sydney to Brisbane, and only 50% of the services arrived on schedule. So it's no wonder that the road system now carries 76% of the freight between Sydney and Brisbane and 61% of the freight between Melbourne and Brisbane. The challenge we have is that the amount of freight being carried is forecast to grow dramatically. In that corridor between Sydney and Brisbane over the next 20 years, it's forecast to triple. It's going to be driven by the massive and rapid growth of the population centres all along that corridor. The amount of freight carried between Melbourne and Brisbane is forecast to double in that same period of time. And the amount of freight between Melbourne and Sydney is forecast to increase by 70%. So there is a monumental challenge that confronts us as a nation in this the major East Coast North-South corridor. Our transport reform agenda will enable Australia to meet the challenge of our growing freight task. Firstly, by increasing the efficiency of road transport through the COAG National Reform Agenda, that's the Council of Australian Governments agreed reform agenda. Secondly, through our massive investment in transport infrastructure under the AusLink 1 and 2 programs, and during as a result of those two programs over the 10 years, between 2004 and 2014, we will have committed $38 billion. These are Commonwealth dollars, and obviously through negotiation there's matching funding in many aspects of the deployment of that $38 billion from state and local authorities. But that's the Commonwealth's commitment to dealing with the task and the challenge that we have before us. And that obviously includes, as I announced a couple of weeks ago, the next stage of the planning process for a second rail corridor from Melbourne through to Brisbane. We're looking at that that western corridor that's been identified in the Ernst & Young report. In February of 2006, COAG approved a series of transport market reforms to help ensure that our existing transport infrastructure is used as efficiently as possible. One reform we are pursuing as part of that agenda is performance-based standards, and it's something that Michael Deegan pursues. But it's an exciting initiative that will encourage innovation in heavy vehicle design. It will mean that vehicles are assessed on how well they behave on the road through a set of safety and infrastructure standards, not on how big or heavy they are. It will lead to improvements in both road safety and productivity. We are close to finalising the relevant standards and establishing the review panel that will assess vehicles. We are also working on the initial PBS network that these new vehicles will be able to use. Another major initiative on the horizon is the introduction of B-triples. As the name suggests, a B-triple is based on the standard B-double configuration, but with a third trailer. Transport ministers across Australia have agreed to map the outlines of a B-triple network. This network is largely similar to the current road train network that exists today across all states in Australia, and will be available from the 1st of July 2007. Again, it's based on the performance of these vehicles and the impact, if I can put it simply, per axle on the road infrastructure rather than the actual size of the vehicles. But we need to continue to drive greater productivity and efficiency in these areas. The next step is for industry and the states and territories to look at how and where the network can be expanded. And I know that, again, Michael is doing some work with a number of the state governments in that regard. The third reform I'd like to touch on today is the new national quad-axle policy. Earlier this year, an overwhelming majority of state and territory transport ministers voted in favour of this initiative. The policy will enable the states and territories to develop quad-axle networks that will focus on moving heavy containers from ports to container unloading facilities, so-called intermodal facilities, if you like. These reforms are all about making our existing transport network more efficient and productive. They will also limit the growth in the number of heavy vehicles operating on our roads. Simple, if you think in terms of the environmental debate that's taking place now, by replacing a traditional semi-trailer on our highways with a B-double, you reduce the emissions from that vehicle and increase its capacity by at least 50%. But quite simply, the onus is now on the states and territories to ensure there are adequate networks for these vehicles to use. We will work constructively with those jurisdictions to ensure that we get these productivity gains. And it would be remiss of me if I didn't mention the Productivity Commission's inquiry into road and rail freight infrastructure pricing that was released recently. The Australian Transport Council meeting in May, Transport Ministers welcomed COAG's response to the review's recommendations. We endorsed the need to implement a phased approach to the reform of heavy vehicle charging arrangements. We also supported the ambitious research and policy reform agenda to lay the foundations for considering a move to mass, distance and location pricing. The National Transport Commission will develop a new heavy vehicle charges determination to be implemented from the 1st of July 2008. This is going to be a sensitive and contentious issue to deal with, but one that, as a nation, we must confront and ensure that the correct market signals are sent. The new determination will aim to recover the heavy vehicles' allocated infrastructure costs in total and will also aim to remove cross-subsidisation across heavy vehicle classes. The NTC will release a draft regulation impact statement shortly to facilitate the necessary public consultation on this important reform. And I certainly would encourage industry players to contribute their ideas and thoughts in this process to the NTC. As I indicated earlier, ladies and gentlemen, our government is putting an unprecedented amount of money towards land transport infrastructure investment under the overall AusLink program, which covers our national land transport plan. We are currently investing $15.8 billion under the existing AusLink program, AusLink 1, which continues through until 2009. That started off, I think, if my memory serves me correctly, at around about $12 billion, and then it was increased in recent budgets to the level it is today of $15.8 billion. We will then invest a further $22.3 billion under AusLink 2, which will run through until 2014. Our investment will include $16.8 billion over the 5 years for road and rail projects in the identified AusLink corridor network that we have negotiated with the states. During the coming months, I'll be announcing the details of the major AusLink 2 projects following consultation and discussion with colleagues at state and territory government levels. Two of those consultations are taking place today. I've seen the Minister from New South Wales this morning, and I'm seeing the Minister from Queensland this afternoon to discuss how we maximise the Commonwealth money, the Commonwealth taxpayers' dollars that are being allocated, and how we can maximise the from a state level. And we've seen in both those states significant announcements in recent weeks in their budgets as far as infrastructure investment is concerned. And so we want to maximise the opportunity while we can, whilst the economy is running so well and the nation is as prosperous as it is. Under the existing AusLink program, we are investing $1.4 billion to upgrade the Hume Highway to four lanes from Sydney to the Victorian border. And by June of 2009, there will only be 20 kilometres of two-lane highway left, and we will finish duplicating it under the AusLink 2 program. And that will complete that incredibly important corridor between Sydney and Melbourne. In conjunction with New South Wales, we are investing a total of $1.3 billion in the Pacific Highway from 2006 to 2009. And you'll recall that we began this program of investment in the Pacific Highway between Sydney and Brisbane in 1996. And I reminded my New South Wales colleague this morning that we had to establish a special category of road called RONIs, Roads of National Importance, in 1996 to allocate Commonwealth funding towards the work that's been done on the Pacific Highway, and now obviously it is part of one of the critical AusLink corridors, and we have linked between the 10-year agreed program under the Ronnies through to AusLink 2 in 2009 with extra funding that is being deployed now. But in 2009, about 50% of the highway between Newcastle and Queensland will be four lanes, and we will press on, obviously, with the work and hopefully at an increased rate in AusLink 2, both in terms of the work being done and the amount of money being deployed by both the Commonwealth and the New South Wales Government in that all-important task of developing the Pacific Highway link between Sydney and Brisbane. Ladies and gentlemen, in conjunction with the Australian Rail Track Corporation, we're investing currently under AusLink 1 about $2.4 billion to upgrade the interstate freight rail links, as well as the Hunter Valley rail system, which is predominantly servicing the coal industry in the Hunter Valley. This was via the negotiation of a 60-year lease between the ARTC and the New South Wales Government, and that has enabled us to manage the access regime, but also to significantly invest in critical areas that desperately needed investment in that network. And to give just an example, recently we opened the new Wagga Wagga Rail Bridge over the Murrumbidgee River. And these are quite telling statistics. It gives you an indication of where we are in terms of global standards as far as the efficiency of rail. When we opened the Wagga Wagga Rail Bridge, trains were then, now with the new bridge, able to cross the Murrumbidgee at 80 kilometres an hour, and this was all exciting stuff, instead of having to slow down for many kilometres either side of the Murrumbidgee to 20 kilometres an hour. Now, if I stood on a podium in Europe and said we've made great achievements in the efficiency in rail, we now have a section of our interstate rail network that carries trains at speeds of 80 kilometres an hour, we'd get a belly laugh out of the audience compared to what takes place overseas. But thus is the situation that we are confronted with that we must address as a nation. I mean, it is critically important. If you know, the most compelling statistic is those statistics I gave you earlier about the forecast growth in the freight task across Australia, but particularly in this East Coast corridor. And if we don't do something about rail, then it's all going to end up on the roads, and the roads don't have the capacity to absorb that growth. It is not about carving up the existing piece of pie. It's about absorbing the growth, doing it efficiently, and ensuring that our industries in Australia remain competitive. But that's just one example of And I think that was, I don't know, a $30 or $40 million investment in that bridge over the Murrumbidgee. The ARTC is currently building 17 new passing loops between Melbourne and Junee, which will allow trains to pass each other without stopping. It's begun replacing the wooden railway sleepers with concrete sleepers between Melbourne and Macarthur and between Newcastle and the Queensland border. This job will need more than 2.6 million concrete sleepers, but it means that there will be fewer speed restrictions and less delays on the network. And we're making good progress on replacing that electric staff communications system with a more modern safety system on the network. In total, the projects that we are carrying out will reduce the rail transit time from Melbourne to Sydney by 2 hours and the transit time from Sydney to Brisbane by 4 hours. And if we've got another couple of hours, we can talk about the problems in between. And that's getting through and in amongst the network in here in Sydney. And that is a major challenge, and that is the reason that we're moving ahead and looking at that Western Corridor so that the through traffic doesn't have to try and negotiate its way through the local commuter system here in Sydney. So these rail investments are vitally important, but there are very real limits on what we can achieve by upgrading the existing coastal rail line, and that's the point I'm making. It would require a massive investment somewhere in the vicinity of $10.7 billion to bring the rail transit time down to the point where it would be competitive with the road transport sector. Now, that's the existing north-south corridor along the coast, and that's the figure that was that came out of the Ernst & Young review, $10.7 billion. We would, for example, need to spend about $734 million to replace the border loop with a major tunnel crossing the Border Ranges National Park. The government has therefore decided to carry out a thorough exploration of building an inland rail corridor through parks and then up through western New South Wales to the Queensland border. The proposed route would have a number of important advantages as outlined in the North-South Rail Corridor study, which was conducted for the Commonwealth Government by Ernst & Young. The fastest transit time between Brisbane and Melbourne would be, in that corridor, 20.5 hours via Albury or 21.3 hours via Shepparton. The transit time would be short enough for rail freight to compete effectively with the road transport system, which has got to be the objective. I think that trip is currently around about 40 hours. So the objective would be to halve the travel time between Melbourne and Brisbane. The route that we've identified that is being worked on would support 1.8 kilometre long trains, 1800 metres, travelling at 115 kilometres per hour. At the moment, trains between Brisbane and Sydney are limited to 1.5 kilometres or 1500 metres in length. The trains could be double stacked with containers if the corridor ran through Shepparton and the Bunbury Street Tunnel in Melbourne was upgraded. It's one of the, whether we can get double stacking on there is one of the challenges that remains. As well as carrying bulk commodities and containers between the capital cities, the inland railway would draw in freight from across regional New South Wales. Southern New South Wales grows about 750,000 tonnes of grain. At present, the area is not well serviced by rail. Up to 400,000 tonnes could be transported by rail if the line linked Narrandera to Tokenwall. Similarly, we could expect some of the chilled meat that's produced in southern New South Wales to divert to rail off-road. About 27% of the grain freight from northern New South Wales could be expected to divert from Newcastle to the Port of Brisbane, which would ease congestion along that Hunter Valley line that I mentioned earlier. A high proportion of cotton from the areas north of Narrabri could be expected to divert from Port Botany to the Port of Brisbane. The new railway would have an indicative cost, again out of the Ernst & Young analysis, of $3.6 billion. Remember the figure that I mentioned to upgrade the existing coastal corridor to that efficient level of efficiency was $10.7 billion. The indicative cost of the western corridor is $3.6 billion. It would be built to the Class 1 standard with concrete sleepers and modern in-cab communication systems. We have commissioned the Australian Rail Track Corporation to carry out a $15 million engineering and scoping study to determine the best alignment for the railway within the broad corridor that's been identified. We expect the study to be completed in 2009, hopefully early 2009. The study will prove up the alignment so it can be taken through the statutory planning and approval processes and then into detailed engineering design and onto construction. The study will also scope the project's capital cost to within plus or minus 20% and put together a development and delivery timetable. It will provide the government with a basis for evaluating the opportunity for private sector financing. The project cannot go ahead without private sector funding. The government doesn't intend taking full responsibility for the construction of this critical link. We believe that this should be done by the private sector. Therefore, it has got to be a bankable proposal. because our commitment is to ensure that we get this built, but we get it built with significant private sector financing. It is possible that land acquisition could begin as early as 2010, with construction starting in 2014. As a result of the forecast in the Ernst & Young study, the line needs to be completed and operating by 2019. It is estimated that building a second rail corridor could increase rail's share of the end-to-end freight task between Melbourne and Brisbane from 30% to about 70%. It would lead to a substantial reduction in freight costs, and these cost reductions would and should flow through right through the economy. Rail is already 14% cheaper than road transport on the Melbourne to Brisbane route. Its cost advantage will increase even further after the cap and trade system for carbon emissions is introduced by 2012, because early indications are that rail is considerably less energy intensive than the road transport system. It's been suggested that the government should extend the scoping study to consider a route through the New England region as well as the Far Western Corridor. The North-South Rail Corridor study examined the possibility of routing the inland rail corridor through the New England Tablelands, but that study indicated that a railway on this route, along that alignment, would cost up to $8.5 billion to build, which is more than double the cost, the estimated cost, of the Far Western option. It would not have any operating advantages. The fastest possible transit time from Melbourne to Brisbane along this corridor would be 23.1 hours via Albury compared to 20.5 hours via Albury on the preferred Western Corridor alignment. It would not attract the private sector investment that would be needed to build the line, and we've taken a decision that we're not going to waste any further time nor money going over route options that we know would not be considered by private sector investors. I mentioned earlier, ladies and gentlemen, some of the benefits that have already accrued in productivity and efficiency gains through investments we've made in the Hunter Valley Rail system, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of those to you, given for a whole range of reasons that the Port of Newcastle and exports of coal out of the Hunter Valley have been very, very high on everybody's mind and well profiled in the media in recent times. We've already completed a couple of projects in the system in the Hunter Valley, and the most significant that has been completed is the new Sandgate Rail flyover, which enables the coal trains coming down the Hunter Valley to travel directly to the Kooragang Island coal handling facility without having to stop and give way to local passenger trains and freight trains on the Sydney to Brisbane main line as they go through that section between Hexham and Sandgate. This was an investment of $80 million that we made through ARTC, and along with the introduction of new speed limits in the area, has lifted the capacity of the Hunter Valley Rail network to above 120 million tonnes per annum. The other statistic to bear in mind is the current capacity of the port is around 100 million tonnes per annum. We are going to continue to invest and increase the capacity of the rail network to handle the extra haulage that will be created by increased production from the existing mines and by the new mines that are being planned in the Hunter Valley. And I'm pleased to announce today that the ARTC has now commissioned its new Muswellbrook Junction passing loop, which is a second project that we've undertaken in the Hunter. The project's extension of the existing loop to 1,800 metres will allow a full-length coal train of about 1,550 metres to join the main line, reducing the return cycle time for crossing coal trains by up to 60 minutes, a significant efficiency gain. With the approval of the coal industry, we will begin stage two of the project next year, and it will further increase train speeds and duplicate the line from Muswellbrook to St Heliers. So we are building the rail infrastructure that will be needed to meet the future demand for Australia's coal exports from Newcastle. By way of contrast, the capacity of the coal loaders at the port is only 102 million tonnes per year. We saw recently, and we took a bit of a cynical view to the New South Wales government's planning approval to increase the capacity at the Kooragang coal terminal, held up until after the state election. You'll all recognise that it was a significant political issue around Newcastle during the state election. The approval for the expansions to the coal loading terminal ironically came through after the state election. But it is going to be needed. We are going to continue to increase the capacity of the logistical supply chain leading to the port. The challenge is now before those businesses and authorities that run the port and the coal loader to get on and make the necessary investments to lift the capacity of the actual port itself. Meanwhile, in Queensland, the Queensland Labor government has failed to build rail infrastructure that is needed to support our coal exports that go out through those major ports in Queensland, and the one that's been much in the media in Queensland is the port of Dalrymple Bay. Now, you'll all be aware of the monopoly that is operated in Queensland as far as rail is concerned, and particularly in the coal industry. Now, the capacity of the coal terminal at Dalrymple Bay is currently 60 million tonnes per year. But in May of 2007, Queensland Railways was only able to deliver the equivalent of 49 million tonnes a year to the port. Now, both Newcastle and Dalrymple Bay have always got a great lineup of ships off the coast, standing off waiting for the delivery of coal. You've got capacity in the rail system through investment in New South Wales in the Hunter Valley of 120 million tonnes now, and you can only get 100 million tonnes out of the port. You've got capacity of 60 million tonnes in Queensland at the port, yet a capacity of the logistical supply chain of only 49 million tonnes to get it to the port. It begs the question that there needs to be investment in all aspects of the infrastructure at a time when the global demand is significant. We should be taking greater advantage of our competitive advantages globally, particularly in terms of the resources sector. Now, don't want to make too many political points, but they're just a couple. And it wasn't until the Commonwealth was able to negotiate the 60-year lease on that infrastructure in New South Wales that we were able to start investing significantly in that. What the challenge is that we need to see that sort of investment take place in the logistical supply chains in Queensland, and we need that sort of investment taking place at the ports to ensure that we continue to run efficiently and competitively as we get product out of Australia in one of our significantly important industries. But I would highlight that as an example of what we might expect from a federal Labor government if that were to be elected. We have clearly indicated what we propose to do, not just in the current budget cycle, not just in the out years in that budget cycle, but right through to 2014. We want to ensure that there is an appropriate level of investment takes place in Australia's infrastructure. We want to ensure that there is an opportunity for the private sector to participate in that where that is appropriate and where the economic analysis indicates that it's worthwhile for the private sector to do. But the most important thing that I believe that we've been able to do through our announcements, particularly with AusLink 2, is give certainty to industry, to the private sector investors that we want to attract in terms of the construction industry and maintaining critical mass in Australia to undertake a lot of the work competitively and efficiently that we want to see done in Australia. We have given all those areas of the economy certainty in terms of the level of investment that we want to leverage with the money that we propose to put forward in what's left of AusLink 1 and what we propose to do in AusLink 2, because if we must make these investments, this level of investment if we're to continue to drive the growth that we want to see in Australia and if we want to ensure the international competitiveness of those industries that rely so heavily on those logistical supply chains. It is a great challenge. It's not one that needs to be shouldered just by the Commonwealth. It needs to be shouldered by all levels of government and those areas in the private sector that are involved in the provision and servicing of that critical infrastructure in the Australian economy. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen.